You're listening to Working, the podcast about what people do all day. I'm Jacob Brogan. This season on Working, we took a trip to Baltimore to chat with some of its residents about the various ways they make their livings there. We were hoping to learn a little about the ways that Baltimore shapes their work and about the ways they're shaping Baltimore by working. Our latest episode, the final installment in our Baltimore series, came about when we got an email that opened, "I have a cool job." Responding to it eventually brought us to Baltimore's docks.
Can we come on here?
Yeah.
That's us, arriving at our destination, a multi-masted War of 1812-style schooner called the Pride of Baltimore II. We'd come to interview the author of that email, a guy named Jordan Smith, who serves as co-captain of the Pride. As it turned out, his job was, in fact, quite cool. We talked to him in a cabin below decks, where he spoke to us about the ship's history and his role in its present operations. He also gave us a tour, talked about maintenance, and explained the Pride of Baltimore II's relationship to the city, which shares its name. Then, in a Slate Plus Extra, Captain Smith talks about racing the Pride of Baltimore II, getting into the combination of strategy and efficiency that ensures that this huge, heavy-looking boat can absolutely tear through the water. It's pretty cool. If you're a member, enjoy bonus segments and interview transcripts from Working, plus other great podcast exclusives. Start your 2-week free trial at slate.com/workingplus.
Phil, he's our cook.
Phil?
You ready to get going? All right. What is your name and what do you do?
My name is Jordan Smith. I'm one of the two captains of the Pride of Baltimore II, which is a War of 1812 era recreation of what's called a Baltimore Clipper.
What is a Baltimore Clipper exactly?
Baltimore Clippers were extremely fast vessels that grew up on the Chesapeake Bay. Their hull form and their rig were unique enough that they're recognizable anywhere in the world. And during the War of 1812, they were used pretty much for anything where speed is at a premium, whether you're chasing something or running away from something. So the Pride of Baltimore II, her name comes about because there was a famous captain named Thomas Boyle. That's him. We keep a picture of him here because he is, you know, he's why we have a ship, kind of indirectly speaking. He had a privateer called the Chasseur, which was roughly about the size of this. A privateer is a privately owned, government-licensed warship,
okay,
because we didn't have much of a navy at the time. Mm-hmm. And so we had to turn to this kind of, you know, mercenaries, essentially,
sure,
just to get things done. And Thomas Boyle, his most famous cruise, he actually had a proclamation taken ashore to Lloyd's of London and had it nailed to the door that he was placing the entire British Isles under blockade with just the Chasseur. And he raised all kinds of havoc, and insurance rates went through the roof and captured 30 ships or something like that. And when he got back to Baltimore, the newspapers hailed the Chasseur as the Pride of Baltimore.
Nice.
So move forward to 1977. As part of a revitalization effort of the Inner Harbor, the idea was to recreate one of these famous vessels, a Baltimore Clipper.
Mm-hmm.
And this is Pride of Baltimore II. The first Pride of Baltimore was launched in 1977, but was lost at sea in 1986.
Oh.
And there was an immediate and large outpouring of support to build a second vessel.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a little sign in the F cabin that says, "Remember the jar of pennies," because some kids like all got together and sent us a big jar of pennies to help build the ship. So this vessel was launched in 1988.
What do you do as its co-captain? What are your responsibilities? What's your life like on board?
Well, as the captain of the ship, one of the things is just keeping everything going.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like I spend more time in Home Depot than is entirely proper. I have a little belief that the time I spend like wandering around in Home Depot is not actually subtracted from my lifespan. So so there's that aspect of it. You're the manager, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's a matter of allocating who does what and when and mm-hmm. all that stuff. And the direct hands-on management of the crew is more done by the first mate. And
mm-hmm.
so captains are sort of an upper tier supervisory role for that aspect of things. And then, of course, I sail the ship. And that can vary from just doing a little poking around sailing Baltimore, or last year we went to the Great Lakes. I sailed the ship as far as Duluth, which is the tail end of Lake Superior. It was geographically satisfying because I just kept sailing till there was no more Great Lake, and then I got to turn around and go home.
Was that part of an exhibition? Were you taking people on a tour?
Yes, there are a series of tall ship festivals, and last year it was on the Great Lakes. It's one of the ways that we have to generate some revenue. It can involve taking people sailing. It sometimes can involve what's called deck tours, where we're just alongside a dock and people come on. We have a display that we set up describing the history of the vessel and all that stuff. It's part of our job. We are partially funded by the state, and we're sort of Maryland's tall ship. We go and tell the story of the War of 1812 and the Star Spangled Banner and all that stuff, because the Baltimore Clippers are a kind of indirect reason why we have the Star Spangled Banner. That's why the British came up the Chesapeake to bombard Baltimore, was to get at the shipyards that were building these things, because they were causing so much trouble. So
it's a big part of the nation's history, but also the state's.
Yes, exactly, yeah.
What's your history with regard to this boat? How did you end up the co-captain of a tall ship?
Practice, man.
Have you always been a sailor, though?
Yes, I grew up in a sailing family. I was taken on boats from the age of 6 months onwards. And earlier in life, I was kind of a semi-professional racing sailor. I worked in sail lofts that make sails for boats and did a lot of racing. And as I got into my upper 30s, the boats kept getting lighter and faster, and I kept getting older and creakier. It kind of became time to shift to something else, so that's when I started taking on jobs commanding traditional ships. And as it turns out, this ship, because the Baltimore Clippers are pretty high performance as tall ships go, they're high powered and fast, and we race this vessel a lot. That was part of what appealed to Jan Miles, who is the senior captain. He's been around since this vessel was built and before. He's been here a very long time. And part of what appealed to him about my resume was that combination of performance sailing and traditional sail. So here I am.
But I assume that racing a boat like this one, from your perspective as captain, a lot different than racing like a smaller
boat. It certainly is. It's actually a lot of fun. But it is quite a bit different. And it is an immensely complicated thing to do, even on a simple boat. It's probably the most complicated sport there is. And when you add the size and complexity of this vessel into the mix, it becomes a very, very interesting challenge.
How large is this?
From tip to tip, she's 157 feet.
That's quite large.
Yeah.
When you're not involved in one of these intense races, what are your day-to-day responsibilities on board? Like, the cabin that we're in right now, it looks like there's some bunks, some people sleep on board.
Well, those are the guest cabins.
Oh, okay.
The crew, most of them, live up in what's called the forecastle. It's sort of a bowdlerization of forecastle, in an old-fashioned term. It's kind of a bunk room kind of thing out there. The officers' cabins are aft the engine room. And these are guest cabins. And what they are for is when we're on a passage or a race, you know, moving the ship from one place to the other in whatever way we're doing it, we have a guest crew program where people can sign up and come along. And when we say guest crew, we mean guest crew. We don't mean sitting on deck with a drink with an umbrella in it, you know. We try to make that clear that, like, you know,
are they paying for the responsibility, though?
Yeah. It's
for the opportunity, I suppose.
Yeah,
the opportunity
to
have responsibility.
It's, I forget exactly what the rate is, but it's somewhere around $120 or $130 a day. And we have six slots that we could give over to that at any given time.
How often do you have people on board?
Well, it's when we're traveling.
Okay.
You know? So this year, we are going from here to Charleston, South Carolina. And then we're doing a race from Charleston to Bermuda. And another race from Bermuda to Boston. And then the ship is coming back to Baltimore. So for all of those legs, we will have those guest crew slots filled. And to your question about, like, day-to-day stuff, it's, you know, quite a bit different. Like when we're tied to the dock and working on the ship, it seems to me that my job is to go to Home Depot. But there's certain, you know, we have an office with a staff of around 5 or 6, executive director, a couple of project managers, a media person, and so on. And so there's a certain amount of meeting with them and doing kind of the long range planning sort of stuff, the races, the events, day sales, charters, what ports we're going to visit, and so on and so forth. And when the ship is traveling, of course, then basically I'm making all the navigation and safety decisions and choosing what sail plan is to be set and monitoring the weather and all of that stuff. So it's just a whole different set of responsibilities.
Do you ever literally stand at a wheel of a ship? Is there a wheel on this?
There is.
Ship?
It's aft. More often, I mean, during like the start of a race in particular, I will steer the ship then. Okay. And at various other times, just when it's an all-hands situation and everybody's got to do something, I'll grab it just so there's an extra pair of hands, you know. More often than not, one of the crew is steering. And my counterpart always makes a joke, like, someone said, you don't even have an autopilot on that thing. And he says, what? I have 10 of them.
The crew, that is.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
So this is a very tall ship. Do people, as in my childish imagination of what it is like to crew a tall ship, actually have to climb the masts
and
stuff up there while you're
underway?
Yeah,
if you noticed the yards, which are the cross pieces, mm-hmm. The upper one of those has the topsail furled to it, and it is pretty much exactly like your childish imagination. So they have to climb up there.
I'm giddy with very thought
of
it.
Get out on the yard to furl the sail and all that stuff. Yeah.
Do you ever do that stuff?
I dislike going aloft. I worked as a rigger for many years. I can't even imagine, like, not liking heights and working at the top of sailboat masts all the time is not smart, you know. So I've been up, you know, it's just that it's not required of my job. And so,
yeah.
But if there's something to inspect up there that we have some question about how we're going to fix or something like that,
you'll go check
I'll
it out.
Do it, but I won't love it.
Reluctantly.
Yeah.
What about other things that might interrupt the pleasures of a voyage? Seasickness ever a problem on board?
For some.
Not for you?
No, not for me personally. I've only come close to being seasick once, and that was on a race on a modern boat called the One Design 48. And we were doing a race from Annapolis to Bermuda, and we were crossing the Gulf Stream in probably a 35 knot north wind. And so what happens there is you have the Gulf Stream, which is an ocean current, going north, and you have the wind blowing from the north, and they're against one another. And so the waves get extremely steep very quick.
So the boat's slamming up and down.
Oh yeah,
a lot.
Just leaping up and down. And you know, this was the kind of thing where you know, everyone is wearing a safety harness and is clipped on, and every once in a while, happened 2 or 3 times, waves would break on the boat and wash everyone off the rail to the end of their tethers, like twang, 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 twang. And just when I was steering the boat, I was fine because you have something to concentrate on, but if you're just sitting there, like, getting washing machined, I got a little queasy. I didn't get sick, but I got a little queasy.
Do your guest crew ever get...
It happens. Yeah.
When you're under sail, how do you dress? I mean, do you wear a captain suit, or you just like? So, can you tell us a little bit about how you're dressed today?
We are sponsored by Under Armour. That's what these nice jackets are.
Baltimore-based company.
Yep. They have given us these jackets, and well, that's a different layer, but
polos.
Sure. Yep. And the whole crew has them. Most of them, you'll see they're in their working clothes now. And if you look around, you'll see that their working clothes are spectacularly dirty. Because they're always working with paint and tar and, you know.
Yeah.
And so, in the course of a regular working day, they don't wear the nice duds. But when we're taking passengers on board or when we're working with the state government, like the governor was on board the other day, we kind of get shined up a little bit. And I thank God I do not have to wear, like, there are captains who have to wear that silly, like, Captain Steubing outfit with the...
With the dumb hat and the...
Yeah, and the epaulets and everything. Like, that would have been a deal breaker for me, man.
Just too silly? Do you get to shave, or do you grow a beard while you're out?
Well, I'm just lazy about shaving. I had a beard last year. I had to shave it off recently because I'm upgrading the level of my captain's license, and one of the things I needed was an advanced firefighting class.
Oh.
And in the advanced firefighting class, you go to the Baltimore Fire Academy, and, you know, they set the building on fire, and you have the oxygen bottle and the whole thing. But you can't have a beard. You have to be clean-shaven. It's like an OSHA kind of thing, I suppose.
Do you imagine you'll grow back, though?
Well, if I keep being lazy about shaving, then that's what this will turn into. So.
When you're out for a while, how's the food on board? You've got a nice kitchen here?
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's called a galley on a ship.
Galley, pardon me.
And, you know, when you're out for an extended period, towards the end of the period, pickings can get a little slim sometimes, but most of the time, Phil is very on the ball about the provisioning side of things. So that's part of the planning that we do, is working with him to tell him how long we're going to be away so that he could plan accordingly and just lay in enough provisions for everything. Mm-hmm. And these guys work very, very hard, and so Phil's really great with field hand food, like like stick to
a
your
lot
ribs
of calories
kind of stuff. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Do you find that you get exhausted when you're out, or are you as captain more able to conserve your energy?
What tends to happen, because I don't stand a watch, but I'm on call all the time, is in high traffic situations.
You mean if there are other boats?
Other ships around? Mm-hmm. Ships around? Like on the Great Lakes, this happened several times. You get woken up a lot, and so it's when you have an extended period where you can't really get a decent REM cycle in, you could get a little raggedy, for sure. Yeah. But other times, like on ocean passages and stuff, it could be a pretty peaceful existence.
You're listening to Captain Jordan Smith of the Pride of Baltimore 2. In a minute, he gives us a tour of the ship.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity, much like how their Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. Having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier and could help you save, too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities, like going on a road trip, cooking dinner, and even hitting the gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. Find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
Would you be willing to take us on a little tour of the ship?
Sure, absolutely.
All right, let's check it out.
This is the what's called the forecastle. This is where the majority of the crew sleeps. As you can see, it's kind of a bunk room sort of arrangement. Everyone's got a little privacy curtain, but
it looks pretty cramped, though.
Living space on these things, unless you're the captain of it, is you don't get much solitary space, that's for sure.
Yeah.
Here, what you're standing in is the galley. As you can see, it's pretty well equipped. We have two stoves. This is a propane one. This is a diesel-powered one. We call the diesel-powered one Chernobyl. When the weather is cold, we typically leave the diesel one lit, and it just heats up this whole space pretty nicely.
Looks like a lot of copper. Is that for the backing, for this backsplash there?
Yeah, it's heat shielding, basically, yeah. And the crew, some of them polish it more obsessively than others, but they do polish it. And refrigerator and freezer are underneath this counter here, underneath Haley's birthday cake. And this is called the cabin sole, S-O-L-E.
That's the floor that we're talking about here?
The floor. And as you can see, there's panels that lift up, and underneath there is more storage space.
What kind of stuff do you keep in that storage?
Well, for instance, this pile of junk that you have here, those are our souvenirs that we have t-shirts and hats and such that we can sell people. Those two ship hull models are part of our education program, describing the hull shape of Baltimore Clippers and why they're so fast. So we have that stuff. There's tools, there's spare parts, there's all kinds of things.
So you get a collection of DVDs here?
Yes. We got a flat screen TV that we stow away, and I think that, well, they watched The Princess Bride last night. So every once in a while, we'll even do that, have a movie night on deck out in the ocean, which is pretty fun.
Nice. Super fun.
As we go aft here, these are, that's the cook's cabin, that's Phil's cabin, and Phil and the engineer share that one. These other three are guest cabins.
Is there ever drama when you have people in these kind of close quarters?
It happens, but it doesn't happen as much as you might think. People who do this for a living are either good at living in close quarters or they rapidly stop doing it. Darwin is everywhere, you know what I mean? So like every, you know, I mean, we've had crew members that were a little on the abrasive side. There was one that scolded Phil a little too much last year, and you know,
so not a crew member anymore.
Not a crew member anymore, but he has veto power. The cook has enormous power on a ship.
I wouldn't scold the guy that has a bunch of knives for one thing.
This is the main mast as it goes down and is stepped on the keel.
Is this wood?
Yeah, yeah. They are laminated.
So this is a huge white kind of octagonal pole, I guess, is what it looks like from our perspective down here.
The original spars for this vessel were just trees, basically, one solid piece. They dramatically and spectacularly fell over the side in France about 10 years ago, and so they were replaced with laminated spars. They're still wood, but they're laminated with Resorcinol glue, which makes them stronger and lighter than just a tree, and also more resistant to damage by rot.
Nice.
Because, you know, if one section rots, it's not going to go across a glue line into another section. Whereas a tree is, billions of years of evolution have made trees transmit water. That's what they're for, right? So
you want something that's not going to soak up all that.
Exactly,
that moisture.
Yeah. So we're going to go through this watertight door here.
So this looks much more like a modern ship as we think.
Yeah,
of it.
Yeah.
You just went
from 1812 to, like, you know, a destroyer.
Yeah.
These are engines. They are twin 150 horse Caterpillar diesels.
Mm-hmm. Smells like diesel.
Yeah. We just the engineer just replaced the valve cover gasket on this one. That's our generator.
That's for powering everything.
Now we're plugged into shore power.
Okay.
So we could just get a big cord and just plug into the dock and run all our electric stuff off that. But we can create power through the engine's alternators and through the generator.
Cool.
And over in there, that is the battery bank, the ship's house batteries. We have engine start batteries and those. And those white boxes there are called inverters. They're inverter chargers. So what they do is they charge the batteries, and they also turn DC power, which you get out of a battery, into AC power, which is what you get out of a house outlet.
And there are, looks like little portholes? That's not the right word for it. I don't know. What's the word for these?
Hatches.
Hatches, that's the word.
Yes, yeah.
So there are hatches that are going up to the deck,
right,
from this room here.
Yeah. These are the controls for our water maker. Basically, you take salt water and pump it at very high pressure through extremely fine membranes and make fresh water out of it.
Okay.
It's so that we don't have to carry an enormous amount of water in our water tanks. We can just make it whenever we need it.
Nice. Do you have to replace those filters often?
Yeah, every couple of years. This is the aft cabin. This is where the officers live. That large one behind you there, that is the captain's cabin. So depending on who's working, whether it's Jan or I, that's our home while we're here.
Nice.
And back there and back there are the first and second mate's cabins. And here is one of the heads.
A little shower.
Hand pump toilet. And So this is called a butterfly hatch, and it's both of these lids open up. And so when it gets hot, it's very nice to just kind of have a fan going down here and have that open.
For the listener, looks like a skylight.
Yeah.
In the cabin itself. All the wood, beautiful, heavily varnished. Mm-hmm. Is that practical as well as aesthetic?
Well, it is protection for it. Yeah, yeah.
There's a nice sheen on all of the wooden surfaces.
Right, yeah, yeah. And, you know, anything in the marine environment is extremely harsh, and so protecting the wood is a lot of what we work on. And also, we go through the sort of inner skeleton of the boat, and we, because Baltimore Harbor is brackish, it's not full salt like the ocean, we actually put sodium borate down there because salt water is very good for wood. It pickles it, preserves it. Like ships on the Great Lakes, you'll see them sometimes, they'll take that salt that you get for your driveway and just dump it in the bilge, so the salt water in the bilge.
Huh. Should we go up through here?
Yeah, well, this is the navigation table.
Okay.
As you can see...
You got a radio here?
As you can see, we're pretty modern back here, too. This is our charting program. And
on a nice computer screen there.
Yeah, and I'll show you us. That's us. And what you're seeing here, that's called AIS, Automated Identification System, I think. But it gives you all the large commercial traffic and the name of the ship, the direction it's heading, the speed it's going, how close it will come to you, so on and so forth. And this is single sideband radio for communication way out in the ocean. That is a weather fax machine that will send you weather reports, both in text and as like, you know, weather charts.
You have this whole range of technology on board, it seems like, from different eras of fax machine. It's a hand crank pencil sharpener. But then there's also this advanced mapping system and radios that look like they could be from 20, 30 years ago, just the range from the 19th century to the present.
I call it Smith's first law of technology. And basically, you know, as you pointed out, we have all this old stuff that's been around for centuries, and we have the modern stuff like, you know, fax machines and computers and water makers and so on. And the law is, the ability of a given piece of technology to infuriate me is in inverse proportion to its age. Like, all the old stuff works perfectly every time, and all the stuff that breaks is the new stuff.
I hear that sign, remember the jar of pennies.
Yes, there's the jar of pennies. And this is one of my favorite pictures of the ship. This was taken as she was sailing out of Hawaii, and as you can see, she's rolling. Yeah.
This is fun.
Okay, there. Yeah.
So this is the steering wheel. The wheel turns kind of a gear drive, which you can sort of see there.
That and that really is rudder. Greasy.
That is the rudder post sticking up there. So it's.
So right now we're at the back of the ship. What's the proper nautical term there?
Stern.
We're at the stern.
Yes.
Looking out. So you're facing away from where you're going when you're working the.
You gotta look where you're going.
All right.
It's one of the more common misconceptions that every time, you know, we're sitting at the dock, there'll be people who will come up to the steering wheel because it's mounted on this gearbox, which is behind it, right? And people, they think they're looking at, like, the dashboard of a car or something like that. And so they will walk up to the wheel, and they'll face exactly backwards when they grab the wheel. And it's like, man, the bow is that way, you know? And you know, it's forgivable when we're sitting at the dock, but I've seen people do it tearing along under sail. Like, hey, can I steer? And, you know... We're obviously moving that way, right? and they do the same thing. They face exactly the wrong way.
You have some little small guns on the sides here. Are any of those functional at all?
Those two little ones are not. They are what's called swivel guns. They once were functional, but They got old, the touch holes got corroded, and so we don't fire them anymore. The three of them that you see there, up towards the middle of the ship.
Oh yeah, those are rolling cannons.
Yes, those do fire. We just shoot blanks just to make noise, but sure. It is fun to sail into a harbor and round up close enough to the dock. But when you fire off the cannons, it sets off car alarms. It's one of our more fun things. In another job, and another type of sailing ship, we would do what were called battle sails, in that we had two ships, and we would try to maneuver in the ways that you would have with a sailing ship during a sea battle. Mm. It was challenging and fun, yeah. So this, the largest one here, this is the mainsail. And
it's enormous.
Yeah, right now we just have the lights rigged up.
How high is this mast here?
107.
So almost as long as the vessel itself.
Yeah, exactly. And as you can see, it's called rake. You look up these masts and they're sort of tilted back. Yeah. That's called to rake the mast. And many Chesapeake craft have that attribute, including the Baltimore Clippers and Pungi schooners like the Lady Maryland, who lives over there, and Skipjacks and so on.
What's the function of that angled setup?
It is the subject of much debate. I could give you a synopsis of what I think is the most likely thing. It's more accurate to think of ship design like an organism evolving, and there are mutations. Some of them do nothing, some of them do something, some of them did something and stayed on for later on. And so what I think is going on with the mast rake is, in the early colonial period, there was a great deal of timber around. There were trees all over the place, but cordage, rope, was at a premium. Mm. And if you were going to build a small, like, say, log canoe, and you're going to stick a mast in it, you get a great big tree and you'd stick it in and you'd have it leaning back so it would like support itself a little better when you put load on it with a sail. And also for the reasons of where you would step that mast and have the center of effort of the sail like balanced over where it needed to be in the boat, you would tilt the mast back. And I think over time that just sort of became, well, this is how we do masts. Because you couldn't just take these masts and straighten them because it would fool with where the center of effort of the sail plan is. Mm. However, you could rig this boat so the center of effort of the sail plan was the same and the masts were straight. It would make no difference at all. Huh. I mean, it looks cool, you know.
But, it does look cool.
But Baltimore Clippers are primarily fast because of their hull shape, which is skinny and a very narrow, sharp V. So what's called in historical parlance, it was called sharp built. That's the name that got thrown around when talking about these things. This is our little rowboat. I am going to have fun rowing around St. George's Harbor in Bermuda with a dark and stormy when we get there. And this is another example of new and old at the same time. This stuff is called Vectran, and it's a space-age fiber that we are making our new running force days out of. So we've taken this space-age fiber. This line has a breaking strength of approximately 50,000 pounds.
A lot of pounds.
Yeah. And but we have parceled it and served it like they did back in the day, so it looks like it belongs on a tall ship.
Huh. Love it.
This one and the one on the other side are our life rafts. If the vessel were to sink out from underneath us, these things would float free and a hydrostatic release would inflate them. Hmm. Let's hope that doesn't happen.
I hope not too.
And up here on the bow, this is the anchor windlass. And this is the anchor chain. And we would use this to haul the anchor up. We use it, you know, especially when we travel, we do anchor quite a bit at night. looking aloft there, that is, you can see The topsail yard, that's what you were asking about before, whether people climbed up there. Mm-hmm. They most certainly do.
Yeah.
And you can see the foot ropes below the yard that they stand on to sort of lean over the yard like you've seen in, you know, paintings and stuff to furl the sail up.
Cool.
So that is the ship. Thank you for the tour.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thank you for coming down.
You're listening to Captain Jordan Smith. Next, he tells us how he and his crew keep the Pride in peak condition. What are the main things you have to look after? What are the things that take you to Home Depot?
Well, it's all about, with a wooden vessel, you always have your eye out for rot. Pride had very, very good timber selected for her when she was built, and so we've had very minimal problems with that. But it's a constant matter of keeping the wood coated. Mm. So a lot of painting, a lot of varnishing. Like all the deck seams are caulked with pitch, and every once in a while one will spring a leak, and that has to be redone. So it's very much a constant refinishing effort that comes in waves when we have time to do it. And you never really reach a finishing point, because by the time you reach the finishing point, it's time to start at the beginning again. So, every year we haul the vessel out of the water. We take her down to Portsmouth, Virginia. And there's basically, they have a cradle for us, and it's this giant platform that picks the whole thing up. And that's when we paint the bottom. We re-caulk hull seams as needed on kind of a rotating basis also. Although, of any wooden vessel that I've seen, this thing does not leak at all. I mean, we mopped the bilges out in the fall and came back and looked at them in the spring, and there was nothing there.
What are the maintenance tasks that you dread most, though?
Well, I don't dread them. They have to do them.
That's the prerogative of being captain, I suppose.
That's right. I don't know. I mean, earlier in life when I had to do these kinds of things, and this was before people got smart about wearing dust masks and stuff, but working with the bottom paint can be kind of nasty, because you have to sand a portion of the old stuff off first. And, you know, it's toxic and got nasty chemicals in it and pretty unfun.
But you're smart about it now.
Yeah. And safer. Also, you know, our engineer has to deal with this, but of course they are marine toilets and the pipes are smaller and they get clogged, and getting them unclogged is an extremely unpleasant task.
But imagine just using those toilets is not always a super pleasant task. What about the actual sails themselves? What kind of maintenance goes into those?
The sails are made of this stuff that's called Oceanus, and it's basically Dacron. It's a polyester, so it's a synthetic.
Just like they had in the War of 1812.
Exactly, but it looks like canvas, except it doesn't rot and it doesn't mildew. So a lot of the tall ships use them, and there's always, like, it just sort of depends on what they need. There's a certain amount of, like, small repairs and restitching that goes on usually during the winter.
If they and kind get of, a hole in them or something.
Yeah, exactly.
Like
and like, as needed over the course of the summer. And, sure. And usually, you probably get close on 10 years out of a sail. I mean, it varies depending on how much you use it, of course. But we sail this vessel a lot, and it seems to be pretty much what we get.
Do you keep extras on board in the...
Yeah. Not for everything, but we do have, like, a couple of, you know, heavy weather sails and things like that. Like the jib, for instance.
What part of the sail is the jib? If you can.
The jib is one of the sails. On this ship, it's the second one back. So there's the jib topsail, then the jib, then the staysail, then the foresail, then the mainsail. And then the topsail is above that, right? So the jib, this past winter, required a pretty significant repair. And a company called Quantum Sails in Annapolis let me sort of use their floor space to repair the sail, which was very nice. And most of the time they just charge people for that. But because we're a nonprofit and we're always howling about how poor we are, they did that for us as a donation. And that involved a much more significant effort. You had to pin the whole sail out and replace large portions of three panels. So, you know, like 20 or 30 square feet of it got replaced.
Yeah.
And as I had worked as a sailmaker for many years earlier in life, I sort of dusted off those skills and did that. So
there are, I assume, also a lot of like ropes and cords and everything that have to be looked after.
Yeah, and that stuff, like everything else, it has a service life too, and the service life is related to how much it get used and how much strain it gets put under and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And we have, and it's just a matter of constant monitoring. You know, we have one of the ship's officers is called a bosun, B-O-S-U-N. It's more bowdlerization of boatswain, you know, as in on an old sailing ship, they would take care of all the small craft and the rigging. And that is what the job is doing rig inspections. If she finds something that sets off an alarm bell, she'll show it to us, and we will figure out what we're going to do with it.
So from your perspective, you've sailed modern ships as well.
Mm-hmm.
Are there significant differences for you when you're captaining on a boat like this one as opposed to one of those more modern vessels?
Well,
in terms of your responsibilities and such, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. We have all the modern stuff. We have computer charting, and we have engines, and we have a water maker, and we, you know, so it's got all the stuff. It's just got an old-fashioned rig. And as a sailing machine, Pride compares very favorably to modern boats. I mean, she's high-powered and fast by any standard at all.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, we don't have a washing machine, and that's a shame. But the skills needed and the demands of the job are, they're not identical, but they certainly overlap a lot, depending on what kind of vessel you're on. Yeah.
How does the Pride of Baltimore II fit into Baltimore itself? How much work do you do with and in relationship to the city?
Well, this coming year, we're spending, the majority of the year will be spent in and around Baltimore. And in part, that is out of a desire by the state government,
which partially funds it, yeah,
to work with us and do things around here. Now, that can involve, you know, like receptions for the governor, and we do other stuff with the Port Authority. We do education programs in conjunction with Fort McHenry, history stuff, obviously. And we do public tours and sales, mostly in the inner harbor down where the Constellation is. And, you know, ever since the building of the first Pride of Baltimore, that has been part of the ship's role, is to be the people of Maryland's ship and the people of Baltimore's ship via those things.
You're not from Baltimore originally, though?
I am not. I grew up in Long Island, New York, and I came to Maryland in 1990 to go to college. I went to St. Mary's College, which is down in the southern tip of the state.
Has being co-captain of the Pride of Baltimore given you a different perspective on the city or the state?
Yeah, I mean, I've never exactly ever been a pro-city kind of guy.
Mm-hmm.
But I got to say that Baltimore, it kind of grows on you as a place. It's you know, generally speaking, the atmosphere of Baltimore is a pretty, as cities go, it's a pretty low-key, friendly kind of atmosphere. Mm-hmm. You know, you could go have a beer in a bar and like strike up a conversation easier here than you can in many other places I've been.
Do you ever get to have a beer here on the ship, or is that
Oh yes, we do. Yeah, I mean not when underway,
of course,
you know, and but if when we're tied to the dock for the night and everybody's done with work, then yes.
What's your favorite part about captaining a ship like this one?
Well, I mean, first of all, as in the world of tall ships, the Pride is one of the most famous and recognizable ones in the world. Mm-hmm. And so there's a great deal of, pride that goes with that. I mean, I remember I saw this vessel for the first time in 1992. I was with my parents on our boat in New York Harbor, and I think it was a tall ship event commemorating 500th anniversary of Columbus. And so all the other ships from all over the world, they're all motoring into the harbor and going to their spots up along the Hudson and East Rivers to prepare for the parade the next day. And they're just motoring in, and they're motoring in, and then the Pride comes in with every sail in the locker set, just haul in the mail, you know. And it was, I thought it was the coolest thing I'd ever seen. And so just the opportunity to be the guy doing that is pretty good.
That's awesome. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us about your work and the ship today.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thank you for coming.
It was a pleasure. Thanks so much. Thanks for listening to this episode of Working. I'm Jacob Brogan. We'll be back after a one-week break with the beginning of our Detroit series, which we're really excited about. We hope you'll catch up with our Baltimore series in the meantime, but if you're looking for something else to listen to during the break, you should absolutely check out the Slate Conspiracy Thrillers Movie Club, which is working its way through films like The Manchurian Candidate and They Live that might help explain our own paranoid moment. We'd also love to hear your thoughts about the podcast. Our email address is working@slate.com, and we do read and respond to all of those messages. You can also listen to past episodes at slate.com/working. Working is produced and edited by Mickey Capper.